When Vivian and I got home from the mission field, we were anxious to get married, but the draft papers were waiting for me at my mother's home and stated I had 5 days to report for active duty. I checked with an aunt of mine that worked on the draft board, and she told me that the only way I could get any additional time at home would be if I would enlist in one of the services, in which case I could get maybe 15, 20, 30 days at home before I would be called to active duty. Consequently, before the 5 days were up, I had enlisted in the Army Air Corps with the object of becoming a pilot. And on the 5th day, which happened to be April the 1st, Vivian and I were married in the Salt Lake Temple. The marriage was performed by my uncle, Elder Nicholas G. Smith, who was at that time the acting patriarch for the church. Knowing I was going into service, I asked Uncle Nick to give me a blessing. He had already given me a patriarchal blessing, but I asked for a blessing going into the service. And he did, and when he finished, I couldn't tell you one thing he had said, except he had said that, and this is a quote, "Father, we expect this young man to do his duty, but if it be thy will, we pray that he will never have to take another human life." End of quote. And I thought, fat chance. Here I'm going into the Air Force. I'm going to be a pilot. I'll be dropping bombs on people. I'll be shooting airplanes down. What's the chances of my not taking a human life? And then I more or less forgot about it. I went into the service after we had about 30 days together. We lived in an apartment on Roberta Street in Salt Lake City. Vivian was working at a company in Salt Lake City, and I got work at the Lang Company in Salt Lake, working as a welder's helper. And then I reported for active duty. I was sent out to Kearns Field in West Salt Lake Valley. It was primarily sagebrush before the Army took over. And they built a large camp there, and it was an induction center for several states. The people would come into the service. I was older than most of the recruits because I had had a mission, I'd had some college. Most of the recruits were just young 18-year-olds coming into the service. I remember the very first roll call that I attended, and it's interesting that everybody knew that everybody on that roster was there. The name was called out, Sylvester Smith. Nobody answered. We got all the way down the alphabet to Smith, and everybody had answered, been there. Sergeant called out again, Sylvester Smith. Still nobody answered. And I thought, well, what's the matter with that dummy? Why didn't he answer? We know he's here. Now the sergeant's getting pretty aggravated, and he said again, Sylvester Smith. And it dawned on me who he was calling. Never in my life had I been called Sylvester Smith. I detested the name, and I didn't like it, and I never used it or allowed anybody to use it. But in the Army, I was Sylvester G. Smith, and that was the way it was. There's nothing I could do about it. And I tried, but they insisted a first name, middle initial, last name. The sergeant was really upset, but he understood when I explained the situation to him. Another experience with the first days of in the service, we hadn't even been issued our uniforms when we heard that there was going to be a baseball tournament between different squadrons on the base, and our squadron was invited to have a team. Well, we were all brand new, and nobody knew much about each other, and we didn't know who were athletes and who weren't, but those of us who wanted to play met in a meeting in the barracks, and decided we'd play. We went and got the equipment issued to us, bats, balls, gloves, and we're given a time to practice on the baseball field. We went out to practice, and everybody pretty much chose the position they felt more comfortable at. I chose first base, but there was another man who claimed he'd had a lot of experience at first base, so I let him play the first base, and I played center field. Now, the day we had one practice, and the day that we were supposed to play our game in the afternoon, we were given some medical indoctrination about what we should do to protect our health and take care of our teeth and so forth. During that day also, we got, as I recall, 11 injections of vaccines to protect us against different diseases. And we just walked down between five medics on one side, six on the other, and paused. As we got to each one, he would inject our arm with the particular vaccine he was supposed to give us. That afternoon, after we'd been given our injections, we were told that because of the need for giving us the injections so quickly and all of them together, that we would have pretty sore arms and we ought to go to the barracks and rest. Well, that was fine. All the soldiers went to the barracks and rested, but the fellows who were going to play baseball. So we went out, had our warm-up, played our game. Our arms were sore, but we played our game, and I couldn't tell you if we won or lost. But I can tell you, the next day, those of us who had played baseball, who had been using our arms, didn't have nearly as much pain and suffering as the ones who'd gone to the barracks and lay and taken it easy during the day. As a matter of fact, as I recall, two of them were so sick they had to go to medical call. What they got there, I have no idea. And I don't know them well enough to know what happened. I didn't know them well enough then to ask them what happened, but I do know that those of us who played baseball didn't suffer hardly at all. While I was at Kearns, I was able to get some passes to go home and be with Vivian. Most frequently, they were just passes good till 1 o'clock in the morning, so I had to make sure I caught the bus back to the base. I did have some overnight passes and some weekend passes, which we appreciated very much. And my squadron was assigned to the work on the base. We were the newest squadron. We had to do the work. We had to mow the lawns, trim the lawns, water the trees, sweep the sidewalks, and so forth. Well, one afternoon I had a pass to go home, and I was assigned to be in charge of five other soldiers. The six of us were to water the trees surrounding our squadron area, and the requirement was that each of us, six of us, had to put a bucket of water on each tree. And I don't remember how many trees there were, but it seemed like there were an awful lot. And because I had a pass, I was anxious to get it done. So I really pushed these guys, and they resented it. They didn't see any need of getting it done that quickly, and I told them, look, we get it done. This is our job for the afternoon. We get this done. We got the rest of the afternoon off. I know I've got a pass and want to get off base, but you guys can hit the barracks and rest or sleep. So they cooperated with me, and we started at 1 o'clock. By 4:15, we had the trees all watered. And we hit the barracks, and I was changing my clothes into my Class A uniform so I could leave the base. The other guys were on their beds resting. Here comes the Master Sergeant. The Master Sergeant got really upset at us and demanded what we were doing. And so I spoke right up and said, our assignment was to put six buckets of water on every tree surrounding the squadron area. And it was a big job, and we worked at it. We worked hard at it. And I can guarantee that absolutely 6 buckets of water were on every tree. We didn't miss one. And we've got our job done, and I've got a pass, and I want to go to town, and these men have worked hard. They've earned their rest. He said, like H, you've earned your rest. You get out of that Class A uniform, back into your fatigues. And, of course, I did. And he took the 6 of us out and had us shovel gravel for the rest of the afternoon. But I learned my lesson. I learned what happens in the Army. And so it helped me the rest of my time while I was in the service. I learned not to be too visible. All the time I was in the service, every place I was at, the policy was that there would be athletic competition between the squadrons. And consequently, if you were on the team, you didn't have to take PT, physical training, calisthenics. And I'm telling you, that calisthenics was boring and out in the hot sun. Nobody wanted to do it, including me. And so I managed to get on the squadron team almost every place I was at. However, I can't remember where it was. Maybe it's when I was first assigned to a base and hadn't had a chance to get on the team yet, but I was having to take PT. And I remember, knowing what I knew about the experience at Kearns, I would start limping on the way we were marching out to the PT field. And I'd limp and limp until I got to the PX, and I'd fall out of formation at the PX back of the building and sit down and shake, take my shoe off and shake an imaginary rock out of it. And I put it back on, and I'd take the other shoe off and shake an imaginary rock out of it. And I'd keep doing that until the entire squadron had gone past me. Then I'd get up and go into the PX, do some things. I knew better than to go back to the squadron area. I'd go to the military library on base, and you know, I just then when the squadron was coming back from PT, I'd fall in with them and go back. Well, other people saw what was happening, and pretty soon there was a whole bunch of guys falling out in formation and shaking imaginary rocks out of their shoes. So I quit doing it. And the very day I quit doing, the MPs arrested all the fellows that were sitting there faking their way out of PT. But I didn't get caught. Another experience I had at Kearns was they'd issued us our uniforms, and the shoes made terrible blisters on my feet. And I went to the medics about it, and they treated them, but they didn't kill the pain. And our flight was assigned one day to work on the rifle range. And another man and myself were assigned to work in one of the towers at the range where we could oversee the range and see if anybody was getting close to where they could be heard. And it was great. My feet hurt so bad, I took my shoes off, and I'd kneel on the top of this tower so that my heels were in the sun. And the sun really helped those blisters heal, and I didn't have the pain anymore. The shoes. My feet had become used to the shoes, so I didn't have any more blisters. But we were up on this tower, and I saw a flight of soldiers marching towards the firing range. And the lieutenant in charge was giving them close order drill. They were going back and forth, left and right, platoon front, squad front, so forth. But they were getting closer to the range, so I picked up the telephone and called the office at the range, at the rifle range, and told them there was a flight doing close order drill. They were approaching the range. And he thanked me for calling and sent a man out to get him moved out of the way. I subsequently learned it was a test to see if we were awake up on that tower. They'd had problems with guys just going up there and laying down sleeping. But we didn't get caught on that. We didn't sleep either. Having had experience on the high school rifle team in the ROTC, I qualified as an expert marksman with the carbine. And that's the only weapon that enlisted men in the Air Force were ever allowed to shoot. Officers were allowed to shoot a .45 pistol, but enlisted men only had the carbine. It was not as big or heavy a weapon as the rifle that the soldiers carried. The Garand rifle the soldiers carried, that's G-A-R-A-N-D, which was an automatic rifle and a much superior weapon. I can't remember anything else about inducting at Kearns. But from Kearns, we were sent to the University of North Dakota to attend college for one quarter. The idea was the college training was to make officers and gentlemen out of raw recruits. And I don't know that it had that effect or not, but it was a good experience for me. And especially nice because Vivian came to Grand Forks, North Dakota, where our group was sent, to the University of North Dakota. She got a job in the base kitchen, preparing food, serving it to the engineering detachment that was at the base. I'd got to see her a little more often if she'd been in the Air Force, but that didn't happen. But I did get to see her every weekend. During that time, we were not allowed any overnight passes, but we did get a chance to be together, and we enjoyed that. And one thing about that I'll never forget and always regret, she was pregnant with Becky. And we were eating our dinner at a downtown hotel one Sunday. And she had to go to the bathrooms, and she just started her meal. And she said, "Now don't let them take my meal away while I'm gone." And I was reading the newspaper and didn't see them come and take her meal away. Believe me, I heard about that. And I was willing to order her another one, but she wouldn't have that. I shared what I had left with her, and we had our dessert and left. But I've always regretted I wasn't paying attention, which has caused me a lot of problems throughout my life, not paying attention. At University of North Dakota, along with our college classes that we took, we had 10 hours of flying instruction in Piper Cubs. We were never allowed to solo, but we were allowed to take off, fly the plane, and land it. But the instructor was in the plane at all times. And I remember one time I got off the bus at the airport, and the instructor that I was working with came running over to me instead of me going over to where they instructors usually were. He came running over to me and threw me my parachute and says, "Come on, we're going right now." And so we got in the plane and took off, and it was duck hunting season. And this instructor had his shotgun hidden under his coat and pants. He handed me the stock of the gun, and he had the barrel in his pant leg, and we went over to the plane and got in, and we put the gun together, because every plane, and I think there were 10 or 12 of them, but we all had a certain area where we played, where we practiced, so that planes wouldn't run into each other in the air, so we had to be in a certain place. And where we were, there was a lot of marshes, and we'd seen the ducks, and I'd seen them. But so now it's duck hunting season, and this instructor flies out to, or has me fly out to our area, and then we fly down low. Oh, we were maybe 100 feet above the ground. He said, now just keep flying in a circle. And he's leaning out the window of the airplane, shooting ducks from an airplane. When we got back, we got in his car and rode out there and waited around in this marsh picking up dead ducks. I don't know how many he hit. I was flying the airplane. I wasn't looking much at what he was doing, but there was some goofing off in the military. I enjoyed the time at University of North Dakota. The classes were basic classes. There was some math, a lot of history, a lot of English classes. Of course, there were no physical education classes. We got that at our Army service. But I don't remember very much about it, except that I enjoyed it enough that I bought a University of North Dakota pennant before I left there and sent it home to Vivian to keep for me, and I have it in my office here at home now, along with my BYU pennant. Becky just asked me how long Viv was there in North Dakota. It was, we were there, I think, 3.5 to 4 months for our training, and I think that Viv was there just 2 of those months. I can't remember much, I can't remember anything more about training at North Dakota, except that I was a student officer. Again, I was older and more experienced than the rest of the recruits. And so the officers recognized that, and I was made a student officer. As I recall, I was a student master sergeant, and my responsibilities were to see that everybody was out at every formation. I would call the rolls at formations. We left Grand Forks, North Dakota, headed for California, Santa Ana, California, where we would be tested to see if we would make pilots, bombardiers, or navigators. That was our only choices. It wasn't up to us. It depended on how we passed the various tests that they gave us. But it was interesting, as we got closer, I realized that the train was going to go through Salt Lake City. And we had a stop scheduled in Salt Lake City. So I phoned my parents, and I'm sure I phoned Viv too. As I recall, I think my parents went up and got her, and they were there in the station when we stopped. And all the cadets were allowed to get off the train and rest and walk around, do a little shopping in the depot if they wanted to. And a bell rang for them to come back, and I had them fall in formation, and the officer with me wanted me to call the roll to make sure everybody was there. So I called the roll, and I had them memorized. And I can call that roll today. Amber, Anderson, Babcock, Baylor, Baker, Barnett, Bartlett, Bastian, Bills, Bostrom, Burke, Button, Hewlett, well, maybe I can't. But one of the names I called had gotten on the train. And when he saw they were falling in outside, he started out of the train door just as I called his name. And so he answered here and then stepped back in the train. And the officer with us stopped me and sent me in the train to get him to come out and get in the formation. And his name was Amber, one of the first ones I called. We went on to San Diego, where we took a lot of tests. intelligence tests, writing tests, Rube Goldberg type tests that measured our reaction time. I can't think of the term I want to use, but anyway, you were rated 1 to 10. You had to have a 7 to qualify for pilot or for bombardier or for navigator, and I qualified 9.79. Pilot, bombardier, navigator, all three I qualified for. The last thing we had to do was be interviewed by a psychiatrist. And this psychiatrist had me sit in his office. He looked at me, and then he picked up a paperweight off his desk, and he threw it up in the air 3 or 4 times, caught it, and finally set it down at his desk and said to me, "Mr. Smith, could an angel hold something material like this paperweight?" So I realize he's somewhere in my records found out that I've been a Mormon missionary, and he's heard the story of the angel Moroni and the golden plates. So I proceeded to tell him about angels and resurrected beings and departed spirits and pre-existent spirits. Wound up selling him a Book of Mormon that I had in my pocket. I tried to give it to him, but he wouldn't allow me to give it to him. He gave me $2 for it, so I gave it to him. And that son of a gun washed me out. He said, "You know, you don't belong in the flying service. You belong in the chaplain's corps." But I didn't qualify to be a chaplain. You have to have a degree to be a chaplain. So I appealed my discharge. I did everything I could to get back in, but it wasn't to be. So they sent me to a radio mechanics school. No, radio operator school at Scott Field, Illinois. And I had an interesting experience at Scott Field. The instructor of our class said to me one day, "Hey, Glenn, I've overheard several conversations you've had with some of the other soldiers. And I know you're a Mormon. Would you like to represent the Mormon Church at a meeting we'll have? I'm in control of the program for this meeting we have among permanent party. We'd have different people come and talk to us about all different subjects. And this next meeting, we're going to have the post chaplain, who is a Catholic, talk about the Catholic Church, and some minister from St. Louis, who was a dean of the Episcopalian Church. And I just had the thought, maybe you'd like to represent the Mormons." "Absolutely, I'll be glad to do that." And I thought, holy cow, what have I let myself in for? I did a lot of praying, and I did some studying, scripture reading, and we got there that night. The first speaker was the Catholic chaplain, and he was nice about it, but he took some issue with the Protestants, how wrong they were. And this dean from the Episcopalian Church spoke next, and he was nice about it too, but he took some issue about differences between them and the Catholics and why the Catholics were wrong and he was right. Then Private Glenn Smith was announced as representing the Mormon Church. Boy, did I have the attention of those two speakers. And I got up and told briefly the Joseph Smith story, and then I went right to the present day, how the Mormon Church took care of its people. I talked about our welfare plan, how we, through the Depression, had helped people, and so they weren't starving, and made work for them. We did things to help people. And after I'd spoken, then it was open to questions. And the questions that came to me were about the church and how it did things. No matter what question was asked the chaplain and the dean, they turned it around to trying to show how wrong the Mormons were. when the time was up and the meeting was time to be over with, we had other assignments to get to. I got the last word in when I said, "Well, brethren, I know your churches do a lot of good, and my church always recognizes other churches for the good they do. But I would suggest that the Savior told us how to find the true church when he said, by their fruits ye shall know them." While I was at Scott Field, a directive came down that all the graduates of the radio operator school would be sent to gunnery school, aerial gunnery school, when they graduated. And I thought to myself, aerial gunnery school? I don't have enough killer's instinct to be a pilot. How do I have enough to be a gunner? So I went to the post commandant and told him what had happened, how I'd been washed out because I was a Mormon missionary and I didn't have enough killer's instinct to be a pilot. I didn't have enough to be a gunner either. And he was sympathetic, but he said, "There's nothing I can do. His directions have come down from headquarters. That's the way it has to be." And I said, "Well, they can put me in an airplane. They make me put my hands on the gun. But I'm promising you, I'm never going to pull a trigger." And he said, "Well, we'll see what happens. We'll give you a week on KP to see if you change your mind." So I was put on KP for a week, and I didn't change my mind. And kitchen police. You had to wash the dishes, serve the food, peel the potatoes. It was not good duty. It was hard, dirty, hard work. So after a week on KP, I told them I hadn't changed my mind. If I was on KP the rest of the war, that's the way it would be. I was not going to be a gunner unless they would reinstate me in flying school, which I was qualified for. So instead, they transferred me to a radio mechanic school. And I met two good friends there. One's name was Al Smith, and the other was, I can't remember the name, but he was of the Jewish faith. And after we were both out of the service, we kept in contact. Matter of fact, when we were transferred to different places, we kept casual contact, writing occasional letters. Jerry is his name, Jerry. Oh, starts with an N. Maybe it'll come to me before I get through talking about it. Anyway, these two and I became really good friends. Our bunks were right close together. And all three of us played on the squadron baseball team. And they were both gone when it came time for basketball. And I was still there. What happened is, I graduated with the tied for third for the third highest grades of the graduating class of that month. And as I recall, it was about 1,000 men graduated that day. They took the top two men and the man who had tied for third, who was also in my squadron, incidentally, and sent them to radar school. And they kept me at Truex Field to teach radio mechanics in the school that I just graduated from. I didn't apply to be a teacher. I didn't even know about it. I was just ordered to report to a meeting, and there were six of us. Five of them were veterans who'd been wounded overseas and brought home, and now were healed from their wounds, and had gone through the course and had high grades, were acceptable as teachers. So the six of us were made instructors in the radio mechanics school. And that was really great. We lived off the base. We had our wives with us. It's just like having a job. I'd get up in the morning and go to work, teach my class. Instead of going to PT, I'd go practice baseball, football, or basketball, or run track, whatever it was at that time. And then I'd go home and I'd stop at the Rayovac battery plant and work 4 hours making batteries for walkie-talkies that were used in the war. I'd go home and be with Vivian the rest of the evening, Vivian and Becky. And when I'd taken a furlough, and I can't remember when, Vivian got pregnant with twins. We didn't know it at the time, but when she got to Truex Field in Madison, Wisconsin, she went to see the Army doctor, of course, and he told her she was 5 months along, and she said, "It can't be. I wasn't with my husband 5 months ago." And he says, "I don't care whose husband you were with. You're 5 months and pregnant." And what we didn't know, of course, was she was larger than usual. She was carrying twins. But we certainly lost faith in that doctor, but he had no choice. We had to go to him. Anyway, I taught classes, and it was a good experience. I even had the honor student in my class. Each class that went through, there were about 10 classes, all teaching the same thing. We were all teaching radio transmitters. And after the students had been through transmitter school, then they'd go to receiver school. And one other thing I don't remember, but I'd been through all three of them, but I don't remember now what the other one was. Anyway, one of the things you did in the transmitter class was you made a transmitter. Every student had to build a radio transmitter that had to work. And the transmitters were graded. In one of my classes, I had a student that got the best transmitter of the class. Of course, he gets most of the credit, and he should, but the instructor would get some pats on the back for it also. Anyway, the war in Europe was now over, and the veterans were coming home who'd been in combat, who'd been over in Europe, overseas, and they were replacing those of us who'd been in the States. And you couldn't argue with the system. That was only fair. And so I had some furlough time coming. I knew I had to get pregnant Viv and Becky home to Salt Lake before I was transferred. So I applied for my furlough time, and it was granted. We settled with the rent with the place where we were living. And we were waiting there. There was another couple living there too, LDS couple. And he wasn't on transfer yet, so he was going to still live there. And so we could just stay till came time for us to get the train. And he was going to drive us down to the train. And while we were waiting, here come Master Sergeant from my squadron and said, "Smith, here's some orders. Your furlough's been canceled. You're going to be sent to Okinawa." I could have died. I couldn't send Vivian home alone. I didn't have any way to get her home except to take her myself on the train. We'd paid for the train tickets. We didn't have a lot of money. I was absolutely sick. So I go back out to the base and I go to my squadron commander, captain, and I explain to him the situation. And he's a typical soldier, military officer, a West Point man. "Tough luck, soldier. This is the way it's going to be." Well, I went out behind one of the barracks there where there was nobody around and knelt down and prayed. And thought came to me, go talk to the post chaplain. Now, the post chaplain knew me because early in my experience at Truex Field, I'd gone to see him. I'd seen on the bulletin board every once in a while, "Next Wednesday is St. So-and-so's day, St. Patrick's Day, Wednesday, March the 14th, 17th. And so all Catholic soldiers are excused from duty. Or I'd see next Sunday or weekend is Hanukkah for the Jewish soldiers. All Jewish soldiers are excused from duty. And this was in the first week of July. The idea occurred to me, well, look, the 24th of July is a Mormon holiday. Why don't we get that day off? So I went to the post chaplain. I went to my squadron chaplain. He says, I don't think you got a chance, but if you do, you got to go to the post chaplain. So I did. And I talked to him and visited with him, and I told him, and he said, well, he says, if we're going to be fair to the Mormons, or to the Jews and Catholics, let them off. We need to let you off, too. He said, I'm going to do a little research, make sure you're not pulling my leg. And he did. And the Mormons all got the 24th of July off. So he knew me. So I went to him and told him what was happening with getting my wife and family home and my papers. What about my furlough had been canceled. He says, you still have the papers? And I said, yes, I have them right here. I thought my captain had asked for them, but he didn't, so I just kept them. He said, all right, that's fine. Go take your wife home. I'll take care of it. And believe me, when I got back to the house, I got the stuff packed in a friend's car and went down to the train station. We waited down there. I didn't want them knowing where they could find me. So brought you all home, then I went back, and I was on, I can't remember what they call it, where you're not assigned a permanent job, there's a name for it. It's a temporary situation where you don't have an assigned job, and so you do the work on the post, you mow the lawns, do KP if it's necessary, whatever. So here I am waiting my orders to go to Okinawa, and all of a sudden Vivian gives birth to twins. Now, you got out of the service on the basis of how many points you had accumulated. You got so many points for each month you were in the service. You got so many points for being married. You got so many points for each child. You got more points for being overseas. You got more points if you've been in combat. If you'd earned a medal, you got more points. And so Vivian gave birth to twins. Each child is worth 12 points. Overnight, I got 24 more points. Now I'm qualified for discharge. I don't go to Okinawa. Everybody in my group goes to Okinawa but me. I'm sent down to Chanute Field. When I got to Chanute Field, it was a discharge center. They had so many soldiers waiting discharge that it was economically smart for the government to give the extra soldiers furlough time. They didn't have to feed them. They had more soldiers than they needed to take care of the jobs at the base. And so I got a furlough and went home. And that's when I went deer hunting with my brother Ralph. Remember on the deer hunting story. That was the furlough I was home on. And I was supposed to have 30 days. And just before my birthday, I got the telegram to get back to the base to pick up my discharge. And so I hitchhiked back to Chanute Field. Hitchhiking you don't want to do nowadays. It's not safe. But in those days, and especially during the war, people were sympathetic to soldiers. You stand on the highway and wave at cars as they go by, and they knew you were asking for a ride. If they were so inclined, they'd stop and you'd get a ride. And it really wasn't a problem. I'm sure I got back to the base practically as soon as if I'd gone on the bus or the train. Maybe not the train, but anyway, I got back. And the first day I'm back, they call all of us new people out for work assignments for that day. And the first thing that the sergeant did was he said, can anybody in this group use a typewriter? So I put up my hand, I could type. And there were a half a dozen others or more, I don't know, but he happened to choose me. So after he'd assigned the rest of the soldiers where they were to go, where they were to work that day, he took me in the orderly room and he said, "Now, there's this stack of papers, all have a few names on them. These are the people that have to be on work call every day. What I'd like you to do is type a single roster of all of these names and then destroy these other pieces of paper. It's too much hassle trying to go from one piece to another." So I did. I typed out a roster of all of the men who should be on work call. And for some reason, I happened to leave my name off. And so when they'd fall out for work call, I'd go out the barracks. Instead of going to work call, I'd get lost somewhere. And after they'd made their assignments, I'd go to the library. I didn't ask for a pass. I just stayed as inconspicuous as possible. And then I saw a notice at the meat warehouse for the PX needed some help, and they were hiring people at 50 cents an hour. So I went over and applied, and I got the job. So instead of going to work for nothing for the Air Force, I was working at the PX for 50 cents an hour. And I just did that until it came time for my discharge. One thing I did was, one day I was standing in the chow line, and that's when I just gotten back from furlough, and I had a silver dollar in my pocket, and I was just playing with it, flipping it up and catching it. One of the guys in the line said, "What do you got there?" And I said, "A silver dollar? Why?" "Silver dollar? I've never seen a silver dollar in my life." "Well, here, take a look." "Man, that's neat. Where do you get those?" I said, "Well, they use them all the time out in Utah where I'm from." "Yeah, well, I'm from back east, and I've never seen one." "I'll give you a dollar and a quarter for it." "Oh, sure, you can have it. I'll sell it to you." So I go down to the local bank the next time I'm off base, and I buy 10 silver dollars. The banks have got them all over. They just don't use them. So after that, every time I'm in line for chow or for a movie or whatever, I'm flipping up silver dollars. I don't remember how many I sold, but sold for a dollar and a quarter. That's right. We need to backtrack here. I was at Scottfield, Madison was not Scottfield, Madison, Scottfield at Belleville, Illinois, when Becky was born. And the Red Cross arranged for me to have a furlough to come home, a 10-day furlough. And I was able to get a flight on an airplane going from St. Louis to Salt Lake, so that I got home early as I could, and before Vivian was released from the hospital. So all the time I prayed for our first baby would be a boy. And didn't turn out to be a boy, and I was disappointed. Felt kind of badly about it, but you know, I wasn't going to let it change things any. I go to the hospital to bring Viv home, and they put her in a wheelchair, and the nurse hands baby Becky to me, and I looked at her, and I didn't want a boy any longer. I wouldn't even consider it. Right, we bonded right there and there. I never regretted our Becky. When I got back to the base, I'd had the 10 days off, and so I was behind in the training. And that's when they talked about sending me to gunnery school. I mentioned what happened from that point on. And I know how nice it was to be home, to bring Becky and Viv home. After I was released, mustered out of duty, the Army gave me my train fare home, and I put it in my pocket and hitchhiked home. And I had a barracks bag, and I had a little handbag that I was carrying. In the middle of the night, I got a ride somewhere in Kansas. And I put my barracks bag and my handbag in the back seat and got in the front seat with this young man who was on his way home from a date. He lived on a farm quite a ways out from the city, and I don't remember city or town it was, but he came to where he had to turn off, and so he stopped the car, and I jumped out of the car and grabbed my barracks bag and forgot my other bag, and he took off. And then I went down the street yelling and waving my arms, but he didn't look in his rearview mirror. Or if he did, he didn't see me, and it was night and dark. So I lost my bag, had my scriptures in it, and a lot of personal things in it. The barracks bag primarily had my military things in it, clothes and so forth. And I really felt badly about that. But I hitchhiked home, and we couldn't find a place to live in Salt Lake that we could afford to rent. I didn't have a job, so we were living with Brother and Sister Poole. And I heard of a job out at the Desert Chemical Warfare Depot where they provided housing. And so I went out there, and they just happened to be looking for a sheet metal worker. And I told them I was a sheet metal worker. I'd installed furnaces and air conditioning systems in the past, and I felt I could do the job for them. And so they hired me, and we moved out there. And while we were out there, there was a article in the newspaper about something in this little town where I'd lost my bag, but it gave the name of the local newspaper and its address. So I wrote a letter to the editor of that newspaper and told him what had happened and asked him if he would run a notice in it, and if there's any charge, I'd be happy to send him any charge, anything he wanted, you know. I never heard from the newspaper, but one day I was eating lunch, and one of the postal workers said, "Hey, there's a package for you down at the post office." And we got very little mail out there. I didn't make it a habit of going to the post office every day. But I went down, and there was my bag, and that damn postmaster charged me first-class postage to get that bag back. It was almost $20. I was so angry. But I got my bag back, and everything was in it. To go back, when the twins were born, I was in Chinook Field expecting to get discharged. And when they decided that there were too many soldiers there at the base, they need to send some home on furlough, I came home on furlough. I think earlier I said I hitchhiked home, but that's not the case. I flew home in an Army B-24 that was going to Salt Lake City. I had to take a bus. Can't remember where the plane was leaving. There wasn't an airfield at Chinook Field, so I took this bus to an airfield, Army airfield, and got the plane. And I was just a passenger, and an eventful trip. Get home and called family, and somebody came and got me at the airport, and I went home and saw the twins for the very first time. And when the time was over, I went out the airport because there was an Army air base out there, and found a plane going to Ardmore, Oklahoma. I'd taken too much time at home to hitchhike back. I'd be absent without leave, AWOL. So I knew I had to get a plane, and this plane was going to Ardmore, Oklahoma, and I figured that's a lot closer to Chinook Field than Salt Lake is, so I took the plane to Ardmore. And I got off at the air base at Ardmore and checked, and there was nothing going to the Chinook Field area, nothing going to St. Louis, which was the closest, or Chicago, either one would have been closer. So I took a bus to from Ardmore up to Oklahoma City, and went out to the airport and explained to the officer in charge what I was doing, and he said, hold it a minute. He grabbed his telephone and he called the air controller and said, stop that plane that's taking off for St. Louis. He says, you're just in time. And he put me in a Jeep and sent me out. The plane was parked on the runway, and they opened the door. I stood on the top of the Jeep, and the guy, the sergeant in the airplane, reached down and took my hand and pulled me up in the plane. Well, the stairs were back at the airport. They rolled them up to the planes in those days. They weren't in the planes.